This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The Coen brothers' new movie, Burn After Reading, opens this weekend. It starts off as a spy thriller set in the CIA, but pretty quickly it turns into classic Coen brothers slapstick, sort of like Fargo and The Big Lebowski, a crime comedy with these bumblers who've gotten in way too deep.
What you're engaged in is blackmail. That is a felony, that's for starters.
I'm a mere good Samaritan.
Secondly, the unauthorized dissemination of classified material is a federal crime. If you ever carried out your proposed threat, you would experience such a storm of consequences, my friend, that your empty little head would be spinning faster than the wheels of your Schwinn bicycle back there.
You think that's a Schwinn?
That's John Malkovich in Burn After Reading, and John Malkovich is here with me. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The first scene of this film finds your character, who is a CIA analyst, which is a character very seldom done in film, called Osborne Cox, who we heard shouting at one of his antagonists there. From the very get-go, he's sort of disrespected and enraged, and one has a sense that that's pretty much
how he spends his life, yes.
Exactly. Is there a kinship with you in any way that you can use as you're pretending to be him?
Well, yeah, there's one, but it's just he's pretentious. But he might even be more pretentious than me, if such a thing is imaginable. But no, I don't feel much kinship with him. He is a kind of typical alcoholic and someone who feels very victimized, I think, meaning sort of underappreciated, mid-level, really nothing. He's someone who obviously feels he was destined for greater things, and when he went into the Central Intelligence Agency, he really thought he would sort of be making the world safe for democracy, et cetera, et cetera. Reading the faces of the actors, it just seems like he's a drunk,
right?
Really, and a rather angry one. Since soon after you see him writing his book, he's already incredibly drunk, almost sort of passed out drunk in the late morning. So,
well, and speaking of his book and his pretentiousness, there's a wonderful thing you do playing Osborne Cox a couple of times, which is your pronunciation of his memoir.
Which, yeah, it's really irritating. Yeah.
Which you do in this extreme, comically over-precise French way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you say it?
Memoir. Yeah.
And I was sitting in the screening room laughing aloud each time you did that, and I wondered if that was just your spin on things.
I think I asked them, how do you feel about something like this? It's a kind of thing someone does, and you know those little, like, baseball bats, the little Louisville Sluggers? Anytime somebody does stuff like that, you just want to tap them with one of those.
And no, and it's the character was revealed each time you did that, I felt. Osborne Cox, in addition to being a drunk, is basically, he's a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
You are so often cast as jerks.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
I think in Hollywood, your product is essentially, we could either say it's what you do well, or it's what an audience likes to see you do. I mean, for years, I always was asked to play sort of cold intellectuals, which I'm not either of those things. Probably the only person I ever even vaguely resembled was either Lenny in A Mice and Men or Klimt in the... I did a film of Klimt about 3 years ago.
Now, how on earth do you resemble Lenny in Mice and Men?
Instinctive. Not meaning to do harm. Not ruling out often doing it, but maybe not meaning to. Please. I think the reason why that book appealed so long is people understand that. I think it's a part of most people doing things that have profound negative effect on people and not really meaning it and not being able to help yourself.
We're sort of oafs, a lot of us.
That's perfectly, thank you, perfectly put.
Being John Malkovich came out 9 years ago. It was this instant sort of cult hit. And these days, regularly I hear the phrase used as the sort of modern shorthand for anything that feels surreal or meta.
Uh-huh.
It's entered the language sort of like Alice down the rabbit hole of this mm-hmm. century or something. How does it feel being known so well and so intensely for that movie, that role?
Well, first of all, it's something I wouldn't be that aware of because usually people, you know, yell from passing cars. I mean, once or twice they may yell, "Think fast, Malkovich," but mostly they yell, you know, "Cyrus the virus," or, you know, et cetera,
really?
Et cetera.
Let's listen to a little clip of the film to remind people of being John Malkovich.
Can I get you anything? Want coffee? Water?
No, thank you.
Teresa, get me chicken soup.
Okay.
Chicken soup? Chicken soup? Larry?
I want to get right to the point. From now on, I'm no longer an actor. I'm a puppeteer.
Okay, great.
And I would like to redirect my career so that from now on the name John Malkovich will be synonymous with puppets.
Sure, sure, no problemo. Poof, you're a puppeteer. Just let me make a couple calls.
Just let me make a couple of calls.
I was being John Malkovich. When they came to you with this script and this bizarre idea, what was your first reaction?
I was doing a film in Los Angeles, and I called my producing partner, Russ Smith, and said, "Is there anything there for me to read?" And he kind of said like this, "Yeah, I got something for you to read." Anyway, he sent this thing out, and I read sort of, I don't know, 20 or 30 pages, and I called him. I said, "Russ, incredible piece of writing." And he goes, "Keep reading." Because I hadn't gotten to the part that sort of supposedly I was in. And then I called Russ when I got back to Europe and I said, "Can you have a meeting with this guy and tell him, you know, that we really loved it and I would love to do it as a director and as a producer if he would make it about somebody else, you know, make it being, you know, whoever." But obviously, you know, we weren't going to be producing a film called Being John Malkovich. I mean, obviously. So years passed and then I was home in France and the phone rang and it was Francis Coppola and he asked me would I do him a favor and go up to Paris and meet this boy called Spike Jonze about being John Malkovich. And he said, "Have you read it?" And I said, "Yeah, I read it. It's very funny." And he said, "Well, he wants to do it." And to me, I thought, you know, nobody in their right mind would do that film. I mean, no way. But anyway, I'll go up and, you know, meet the kid and blah, blah, blah. And then I went and met him and talked to him. Mostly, I just remember after sort of 30 minutes, I said, "Wait a second, are you American?" I thought he was Czech because he had this really funny way of speaking English. He'd sort of say, "That's harsh," or "That's okay, but maybe." So I really liked him, and we talked about it really over a long period. And that was my worry, is sort of, will this really sort of do something to my life? In fact, it didn't at all, you know.
So you say.
Well, it didn't. It really didn't, though. I knew that it had achieved a kind of iconography, but I didn't really much relate that to myself, if you see what I mean.
I do, although having your name in the title makes it related to yourself in perpetuity.
Yeah, but what you are publicly or what you're perceived to be publicly, I hate to quote another film I did, but that really is beyond my control. I'd only relate to after I had the first meeting with Charlie Kaufman. We were here in New York somewhere. We had a sort of very early breakfast, and they were kind of trying to talk me into doing it. I had reread it, and I had felt they had taken out a lot of those sort of, not a lot, but several of the kind of really cruel jokes, which I quite liked. And I mentioned that to them.
Cruel jokes at your expense?
Yeah. Are there any other kind? But I mentioned it to them, and Charlie, I mean, this is my memory of it, he may disagree, kind of sniggered. And then when we were leaving the restaurant, we were walking down the street in New York, and I think we were somewhere in the 40s, and then he kind of sidled up to me, and he sort of goes, you know, I just want you to know I'm a really big fan. And I said, Charlie, you know, I read the screenplay. You don't have to do that. And he goes, oh, okay. So.
John Malkovich, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The Coen Brothers' new movie, Burn After Reading, arrives in theaters this weekend. Last week on the show, I had an interview with Lee Israel, the biographer who briefly became a forger, who created letters from famous people and then sold them to make a living. And a few of you were ticked off. On our website, commenters called Lee Israel's actions sickening, abhorrent, and shameless. I quote, one of the people who was upset was Molly Nelson Haber, who's a scholar in New York City.
You treat Lee Israel's admitted theft of manuscripts from library archives as a sort of lark, a form of literary adventure. But her actions have made it all the more difficult for independent scholars, such as myself, to gain access to invaluable materials. At work on a biography based entirely on original autograph letters, I'm routinely subjected to humiliating and time-consuming searches of my briefcase and my notebooks upon entering and exiting archives, all just made absolutely necessary, according to each archive staff, because of the flagrantly selfish and self-serving actions of people like Miss Israel.
Lee Israel is pretty charming, and she didn't hurt anyone, but I got to thinking and I realized I probably was a bit too soft on her during our interview. I also realized that I had once been the victim of a literary forger myself. Somebody posing as me once wrote an article and sold it to a national magazine where it was published with my byline. My wife discovered it and said, why did you write this article? I read it and said, I never wrote it, and it's not a very good imitation of me. Unlike the people whose letters Lee Israel forged, I, number one, happened to be living, and number two, by chance, happened to see this article and got a retraction in the public record. In any event, thank you everyone for writing in, and keep the comments coming at studio360.org. While you're there at the website, you can also sign up to receive our free weekly newsletter and our free podcast. That is Studio 360 for today. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein, Lital Mulad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Catherine Epstein,
Jill Duboff,
Aaron Davis,
Greta Cohn,
Emily Frost,
Chloe Plant,
Hamad Ahmed.
Our story about Greek music was produced with the help of ArtsEdge, the educational website of the Kennedy Center. And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI. Public Radio International.
As the world's largest particle accelerator ever starts to rev up, scientists couldn't be more excited. But a few people think the end of the world is nigh.
There's an entirely different world beyond that black hole.
Writer Lydia Millett wonders what it would be like to have our own black hole right here on Earth.
He was reminded of children at zoos. It was the end of the world show, the apocalypse in a jar.
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI,